Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, scholarship, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is Christopher Johnson, professor of early modern literature at UCLA. He's talking with us by telephone about his book, Memory, Metaphor, and Abi Warburg's Atlas of Images. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Thomas. Glad to be with you.
It's great you could join us. I thought we might start by talking about Abi Warburg, about who he was and why does he, as George D.D. Huberman put it, haunt the discipline of art history and really all humanistic studies.
Warburg, he was generous, visionary, brilliant, complicated, utterly flawed man, navigating, as he liked to say, between polarities constantly. He famously once branded himself as a Hamburger, not a hamburger, a Hamburger by birth, a Hebrew by blood, and a Florentine by heart. So you get a sense of just how many sympathies and maybe even conflicting sympathies that he had. Warburg is often known as the father or grandfather of the iconological method in art history, but he's so much more. He preferred, especially in his late years, to call himself a Kulturwissenschaftler. We would translate it, I suppose, as a scientist of culture, although the question of science is a fraught one for Warburg and for his successors. In any case, he saw his scope as being all of culture, not just art history. That includes literature, philosophy, political history as well. And I guess the reason why he haunts us, and why he somewhat obsesses me, is because of his allergy or his hostility to disciplinary boundaries. He sees himself, he calls himself a Grenzgänger, someone who always is interested in the border lines between disciplines and modes of thought rather than content to remain within one mode of thought. So someone like D.D. Huberman, who writes wonderfully about Warburg, finds in Warburg Freudian, Deleuzian, Nietzschean elements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether one agrees with that or not, or the emphasis on Freud, for instance, has been particularly controversial, Warburg does speak to so many different ways of reading and thinking. Maybe even just to use one of Warburg's own preferred metaphors, he calls himself a seismograph. And he tells us that he writes ghost stories for adults. And those ghost stories have to do with history, but also the adults they're us. They're his contemporaries. They're this generation and the generation before us. So, I mean, that's one of the many reasons why he compels, I think.
His own background, he straddles the 19th and 20th centuries, doesn't he? Though we associate him mostly with the early 20th century, I sometimes sense in him a backward look a bit, or one can't help but think about the German, and to some extent English, but especially German mythographic tradition with Max Müller and James Frazer, although he's doing something much different than what they were doing.
No, the Frazer comparison, I think, is very apt, although there are some mentions by Warburg of Frazer and Müller as well. I would say that there are two strands that are maybe more Germanic, Teutonic than English. There's one that's almost Viconian. He studied with Hermann Usna, who wrote a wonderful book of the Divine Names, or Gotternamen, a comparative, almost Vico-like mythology. I mean, Usna read Vico very closely. He also worked or studied under Theodor Vischer, who wrote wonderfully about symbols and myth and symbol. That's the one hand. On the other hand, there's Jakob Burckhardt and the Burckhardtian notion of history and historiography that Warburg explicitly is imitating and trying to supplement throughout his career. Mm-hmm. So he sees the individual and all of the individual's context in more strictly or even conservative intellectual terms. But then there's the wilder, more symbolic history that he's attracted to as well. And that's, I suppose, another polarity that you could see in his work. I mean, the fact that the viewer's psychology, the viewer of a painting or the spectator of history, that his or her psychology was central, mm-hmm. much more than aesthetic questions, I think is key to understanding what Farberg is up to.
He had a number of close followers, with Panofsky, of course, and Ernst Cassirer and others.
And Gombrich. The history of Farberg's successors or his afterlife mm-hmm. is really interesting because it alternates between neglect, allergy, homage. So let's take Panofsky as an example. A young Panofsky finds a home, finally, when the Warburg Institute is getting going in Hamburg in the 1920s. Panofsky is there, and he's given opportunities to lecture and hone his craft. His iconological method mm-hmm. is very much indebted to Warburg, but I think, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about this later, I think that it's fair to say that Warburg's late work is not very simpatico, if you will, with Panofsky, more scholarly, text-based, iconological method. But the debts there are undeniable. Cassirer comes to Hamburg in 1921 to teach philosophy at the University of Hamburg. He has just finished what scholars call his neo-Kantian phase, and now he's looking at the details, the innumerable contexts of history, and therefore mining the Warburg library that's growing by the day in order to write his magnum opus, which is not very neo-Kantian. I read it much more as Hegelian, his philosophy of symbolic forms. So that philosophy of symbolic forms, compare that exhaustive traditional Begriffsgeschichte type book with Warburg's, say, Atlas of Images,
yes.
which, as it stands, has hardly a word in it.
People like Cassirer and Panofsky, too, to some extent, and Gombrich, their notion of iconography, of reading images, seems compatible with what Warburg is doing early in his career, but after the war, it doesn't seem that way anymore. These seem like closed Hegelian systems, whereas the work that your book is about, the Bilder Atlas, the Atlas of Images, is not like that. It's not about static symbols, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, I know that Warburg envisioned it as a flexible, open form of scholarship that would ideally, and maybe he is somewhat naive in this, that anyone with a certain amount of learning and someone who was interested in learning about the past and how art and literature inform the past and the present could look at it and his so-called method of sequences of images and discern intuitively what structures, he called them universal repeating pathos formulas, how those pathos formulas were deep emotion that nonetheless are structured by the forms of art and literature, how they repeat themselves and how they help us understand who we are as humans. And that's very different than the, as you call it, Hegelian or Kantian yeah. accounts of the past that Cassirer and to maybe a lesser extent Gombrich offer.
And Warburg also strikes me as an Aristotelian, at least insofar as these organic motives, symbols, seem to be sensation-based, or at least in part sensation-based.
Right. It is. You are absolutely right that Warburg never wants to lose sight of the image, its materiality, but more urgently for him, especially in his late work, how that image itself straddles a world of sensations, emotions, which often are dangerous emotions, are often dangerous passions for Warburg, and on the other hand, abstraction, removal from the world, which has its dangers as well. And thus, Warburg, especially in the late work, wants to oscillate between these two worlds of sensations, of sensuous detail, and abstract, repeating even universal forms.
Interesting to recognize that art can be dangerous, isn't it?
Very dangerous. As Warburg was hospitalized, institutionalized for four plus years after World War I, partly in reaction to the war and the political events, the anti-Semitism, etc., that followed World War I, but also just the gruesome images, violence he collected, images from the war, then trying to make sense of that, trying to make sense of his place in the present and his understanding of the past, he lost his sanity, and he was institutionalized in Switzerland, in Kreuzlingen, for 3 years. First misdiagnosed as schizophrenic, mm-hmm. but then a better diagnosis was offered as manic depressive. And it's only after he emerges from Kreuzlingen in 1924 that he comes up with this method of the sequence of images, which with the help of Soxel, Fritz Soxel, his devoted assistant and often source of intellectual inspiration, he begins another way of mediating these images. Yes, so I guess mediation is key here.
Without words. So I want to talk about then that method, the Bilder Atlas. But before I do, I just wanted to ask, you know, for a long time, Warburg seemed to have fallen out of fashion. I mean, he's always there haunting the art historians. His influence is certainly understood for anyone working in iconography or iconology. But on the whole, it wasn't felt, I think, that he had anything to offer us in terms of contemporary problems. But recently, there's been just a surge of publication about him. I mean, a book came across my desk just yesterday, Emily Levine's Dreamland of the Humanities, which was about...
Yes, I've seen it.
Very fine. And there have been several exhibits of facsimiles of the Bilder Atlas. There's a digital version of it actually online, I think.
Well, I should plug Cornell University Press and the Warburg Institute. We've been developing a site. It's called Nemusyne, M-N-E-M-O-S-Y-N-E, and you can just Google it, which has 10 of the panels of the Atlas, and we are commenting on them. Different people are writing pathways. It's a kind of experimental project to put high-quality images of the Atlas online.
I'll post it on our website. So anyway,
back to your question.
Yeah, there has been a surge of interest, and why is he back in style, to use a loaded word?
Well, the first part of your question was, why did he fall out of style?
Yes,
out of fashion. And firstly, it had to do with that he published so little in his life, relatively little in his lifetime, compared to someone like Gombrich, like Panofsky, like Witkowa, and the other Warburgians. He had scant representation. And what he did publish, aside from some of the early, more iconological or iconographic essays, tended to be, say, more esoteric, or maybe esoteric is not the exactly correct word, but tended to exemplify his method rather than explain his method. He never really was able to write programmatically.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the 1920 essay on Martin Luther and astrology. You have the essay from 1913 on the frescoes and the Schifanoia in Ferrara. You have a few key essays on Botticelli. Some art historians continue to read them. But Warburg's methods were not easily classifiable, especially in comparison to someone like Panofsky, who was able to clarify and systematize the iconographic, iconological method. So Warburg, in a sense, fell not into oblivion, but was neglected for his more polished successors.
Mm-hmm.
Then, with the revival of Benjamin in the 80s, as I see it, in Germany, Warburg rode that wave somewhat as well. I mean, both German Jewish intellectuals who, in one way or another, were victims of Warburg's library, his life work. We can talk about that now. I'd love to talk about the library.
Mm-hmm.
Was, of course, the Nazis threatened to confiscate it and it moved to England in 1933, where it now forms the basis of the Warburg Institute in London. Benjamin, of course, who commits suicide in 1940, fleeing the Nazis. So there's that. And Germans have, from mid-80s onward, have worked and done magnificent work on Warburg. And now, with the addition of his collected works being published in Germany since 2000, or actually 1998, there are the texts that we can work on. And there's that. In Italy, Carlo Ginzburg and Giorgio Agamben have been key in moving, inspiring, explicating, or at the very least, theorizing Warburg's work in such a way that younger generations of scholars have been inspired to work on Warburg. And then in the States and in, well, first, let's take England.
Mm-hmm.
England, for a long time, Warburg, as the titular figure for the Warburg Institute, was kind of the mad uncle, the something of an embarrassment to the English art historical community. And Chris Wood at Yale has written wonderfully about this. I mean, in a sense, what it was is that Valborg's methods didn't sit well with more positivist approaches
to art.
And so it's only recently that Peter Mack at the Valborg Institute has really opened the door to scholars studying his legacy, despite the fact that the archive is there in London. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the translation in 1999 of the Getty volume that translates the collected works of Valborg, now having the English versions of Valborg's writings, has just made him much more accessible, and his work now stands as a provocation in many languages, not just in German.
Some of his ideas seem very, very contemporary. I mean, his early interest in the economic conditions that went to make Renaissance art. I mean, he was investigating very early business records of artists and that kind of thing when he was in Florence. And he was very interested in material conditions out of which art comes.
Yes, I mean, part of this was biographical. Mm-hmm. He was himself the son of a very prominent, wealthy Hamburg banking family. In fact, he rejected his birthright, namely as the eldest son, to take over the banking business with one proviso, that he would be allowed to buy as many books as his scholarly needs required. And of course, his brothers had no idea that he would found a library as well. So, but on an intellectual level, his 1905 and 1907 essays on the Sassetti family of Florentine bankers, which emphasize how Sassetti, a patron of the arts, but also someone who, well, Ghirlandaio in a number of famous works, represents the Sassetti family. And the fact that Sassetti had a self-consciousness or a self-feeling, a Selbstgefühl, as Valborg writes, was key to him because, in effect, this is what he himself desired to have vis-a-vis Renaissance art. He closes the historical distance not only on the basis of biography, but on the basis of this self-consciousness, this self-awareness, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yeah, interesting. So can we talk about, then, the Bilder Atlas itself? Fritz Saxel seems to have come up with the idea.
This is controversial.
Yeah.
Maybe to simplify things, when Valborg comes out of the sanatorium in 1924, and he's still healing, Saxel, in a sense, shows him a number of panels with images that Valborg had worked on before the war, in a sense, recalling him to the very images that moved his scholarship for 20 years. These panels were loosely based on the kind of scientific and pedagogic atlases that are so central to 19th century German, English science investigations. I mean, if you read the wonderful book by Peter Gallison and Lorraine Dastin, Objectivity, they talk about these atlases. But what Valborg does, or what he hits upon, is that this method of placing 10, 15, 20, 25 images on a board, maybe covered with black fabric, and pinning them up and then creating a sequence of these boards, was a way by which he could get around the problem that he long had of writing about the history and context and constellations of image and making these constellations visible both to himself as a laboratory, as he frequently calls it, mm-hmm. but also as a way of showing, modeling, making palpable his ideas to others. So in the Atlas itself, we have records of various versions, but let's just simplify it by talking about the last version, the so-called last version, which has 63 of these panels, mm-hmm. Almost 1,000 images in all. The Atlas itself begins with a series of maps, cosmographical images, then moves alternating between cosmography, cosmology, astrology, astronomy on the one hand, and then on the other hand, more strictly art historical subjects from antiquity, Greek, Greco-Roman, but also Persian antiquity, mm-hmm. through the Middle Ages, with looks to the side, or if you will, to Arabic astrology and astronomy, up to the Quattrocento, which is really the focus. Late Quattrocento is the focus, to my mind and others, the Atlas, then moving to figures like, Rembrandt in the Baroque as a key figure, then Manet, he worked on in the last couple of years of his life, finally ending with contemporary events. What's happening in Rome in 1929? He dies in 1929 as well.
Can you give us an example of the kind of diagrammatic thinking that the panel set up?
Sure. Well, first thing that might be helpful to know is that what we have are photographs of the actual panels. They're no longer extant.
Mm-hmm.
We know that most of the original images, if we can talk about photographs that were culled from art historical books, sometimes were taken by Warburg himself, drawings, manuscript pages, were largely in black and white. So the images on the panels, the black and white results in a kind of leveling effect, which to my mind makes it easier for Warburg and for us to compare images that may be from different periods by different artists, obviously, as well. So what happens is, especially in the middle sequence, so I'm thinking of panels 41 through 49, a series of more or less 10 panels. Warburg alternates between showing how an artist like Ghirlandaio or Giotto or Mantegna is able to balance, and balance is the key word, direct representation of sensation. So the Lao Kuan statue figures centrally in panel 41A. And we see both Roman representations, obviously the statue itself, but also imitations by people like Dürer, or we see Virgil manuscript from 1470. There's references to Poliziano's Orfeo. In other words, he's interested in how Lao Kuan in this panel is what he calls Marx's Baroque degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is not historically accurate or is historically questionable. But in his history or the psychology of styles, Warburg sees the appearance, the unearthing in 1506 of the Lao Kuan statue in Rome as happening at exactly the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Because here is the same moment that Dürer is trying to, well, allow his style to be influenced by Italian humanism and the great Italian Quattrocento artist, but also prevent it from becoming too mannerist.
Mm-hmm.
So we see this struggle in panel 41A. Then he continues on, and, well, even panel 41A has an image from El Greco, the only appearance of El Greco in the entire atlas, as if to say, here is the possibility of the Baroque, and Warburg's ambivalence towards the Baroque, well, it's another topic altogether, but it's interesting. In other words, the rhetoric of muscles mm-hmm. is overly animated for Warburg in this panel. We know from his other writing,
mm-hmm.
but we can also now see it. It's present before our eyes. So what does he do? He, in a sense, in the subsequent panels, mediates that by following the history of painterly imitation through the representations of Pentheus, of the meditation on Christ's suffering. He calls the title of the subsequent panel, panel 42, is one of the subtitles is inversion, energetic inversion.
Mm-hmm.
And that inversion is essentially accomplished by Christianity, but Christianity meditating both on so-called pagan themes and more orthodox Christian themes. So Donatello appears in panel 42.
Mm-hmm.
So does Mantegna, but Mantegna appears there only in a very small, not centrally located image. I think there are about 16 images on panel 42. But it's only when we look at the subsequent sequence of panels that we see that Mantegna actually has a central role in Warburg's history of this inversion of these representations of these emotions.
So is the subject here then the art, or is it the gesture in the art? Is the subject here culture, culture being the culture of gestures?
Yes.
Yes,
the
yeah.
The answer to your question is absolutely yes.
Yes.
He's uninterested in art per se.
Per se. It's interesting because he is using black and white photographs of works of art, which traditional art historians, though that's what they used to work in, and we all do work with representations, always will make the caveat that, you know, you really have to go and see the real thing. But here, the fact that these are black and white, you're not bogged down in the work itself, in a sense. It's an added value, then.
The presentation via the black and white photographs allows for what I call Warburg's combinatory art to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I guess, a more thematic or even conceptual reason why black and white might be important for Warburg, aside from its methodological advantages. Namely, he saw the relationship between antiquity, pagan antiquity, Greco-Roman, often even Arabic astrology in the Middle Ages, as being filtered by artists like Ghirlandaio, who use the grisaille technique, that is, placing in, I'm thinking of Ghirlandaio's Slaughter of the Innocents, for instance, placing in grisaille, or grayscale,
mm-hmm.
the images of extreme violence, so that you have in the background, so the grayscale already mediates those images of great violence or great passion for Warburg, even as the main part or principal part of the painting is in brilliant color. So what he is doing in the atlas in general is what he sees a painter like Ghirlandaio doing in individual paintings.
Yeah. Why is it that pathos is so central to these readings and figures that express pathos and suffering? It seems to run through almost all of them.
Yes, yes, it does. Warburg often wrote in his notebooks about a Leidschatz, a treasury of woe that he collected, that he was collecting for. And he also, especially in his late years when he was working on cosmography and astrology, saw himself as participating in what he called the dialectic of the monster.
Mm-hmm.
And that dialectic of the monster was, again, being able to, along with astrologers, along with the painters that he studied from the past, being able himself to wrestle with the more unmediated, dangerous passions, and then, if not transcend, at least not be harmed by them.
Mm-hmm.
He refashioned a motto by Kepler. Kepler was one of his most important figures, and we maybe will have time to talk about Warburg, Kepler, and Bruno,
mm-hmm.
but he took Kepler's adage, per ad astra, via the monster toward the stars, and refashioned it as via the monster toward the sphere, to say, in a sense, that I need the monstrosity of history and the monstrosity or the gruesome or unmediated in art, etc., to transcend, to conceptualize, to ultimately find some sort of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And this was both intellectual and personal, psychological contentment.
We were recently talking on our program with a German media historian, Wolfgang Ernst, about what he calls media archaeology, which essentially involves cultivating an understanding of the past by examining technological media, the Edison cylinder, for instance, through non-discursive means. And he's very interested in temporalities in technology. The fact that you can actually, you know, by listening to an Edison cylinder, hear Caruso's voice long after Caruso was dead. It breaks up the notion of history as a linear thing in the way we ordinarily construe it. And interestingly, I noticed, you know, you mentioned in the book Giorgio Agamben's description of the Filter Atlas as something akin to an electronic condenser. And I wonder about the idea, in any case, of a non-discursive history. You know, you begin the book talking about the relation between memory and history, and you begin with Helderlin and Gerhard Richter. And I wonder here, is Warburg concerned here with time as well as with cosmography and space, or what Ernst would describe as multiple concurrent temporalities or microtemporalities defined by forces such as, well, recurrence for one, but also entropy. So is he concerned with time? Because he is certainly concerned with history, isn't he? There's a historiography implied by all of this.
No, I think he is in multiple ways. First of all, as far as technology, he was extremely eager to adapt the latest technology for his library. At the same time, he feared the way that technology could close the distance between ourselves and the cosmos. So the Zeppelin, it mm-hmm. figures prominently in many of his works. His so-called snake ritual lecture that he gave while he was still in the sanatorium in 1923, he talks about the telegraph as dangerously destroying the mediation, the metaphoric mediation that he so desperately sought. So in terms of time, technology has both a beneficent role in the sense that we've already talked a bit about the technology of the Bilderatlas, the mm-hmm. way that he uses images and panels to ultimately, and this is one of the reasons I suppose, well, I know that Warburg is not always embraced by Orthodox art historians, to give you essentially a synchronic art history. If you put a Greek statue next to a painting by Ghirlandaio, you're obviously deracinating them. You're ignoring context in order to, I guess, promote what Chris Wood and Alexander Nagel call the anachronic Renaissance, mm-hmm. rather than a Renaissance that follows strictly historical or historicist lines.
Yeah, very interesting.
I also think, on the other hand, though, that kind of synchronicity that Warburg sought, obviously it has its drawbacks. It ignores detail, the very detail that the younger, more iconographic Warburg would want to insist upon. And it ignores context to some extent as well. And yet, and I think this is the rub, for Warburg, that kind of synchronicity, if you will, mm-hmm. is exactly what makes his work as a cultural scientist so urgent for him and hopefully for readers or viewers, mm-hmm. because it allows us to say, look, this image, this artifact, speaks to us in ways that we need not be bogged down by the minutiae of historical knowledge. So the example that comes to mind, or the anecdote really that comes to mind, is Warburg traveled in the mid-1920s, I think it was 26, to show Albert Einstein several of these panels that dealt with astrological themes and magic. Einstein was, I'm loosely quoting, immediately impressed and convinced, mm-hmm. reports Warburg. But Einstein also took the time, and one of the panels depicted Kepler's laws of planetary motion, because Warburg was very interested in the ellipse. Mm-hmm. And Einstein took the time to show Warburg the actual mathematics that inform the elliptical motions of the planet. And so, I mean, that's a nice window in two different ways of seeing the past. Einstein wanted to get it right. Warburg wanted, in a sense, to show why it matters at all.
Yeah, past isn't past. So,
yeah.
So this isn't about synthesis, then, is it? It's about seeing things side by side. I have the sense that Warburg is of this mind. He isn't interested in a Hegelian notion of reconciling opposites.
No, I think that's entirely correct. Warburg thinks metonymically. One thing leads to another, mm-hmm. leads to another, and that process never stops. I think ultimately he sees this process less as synthesis is exactly what he doesn't want. Late in life, when he's working on Bruno in Rome, he finds in Bruno this word synderesis, which is a kind of ironic, syncretic, ethical bringing together of different elements. And Bruno does this explicitly, and Warburg sees himself as imitating that. In the margin of one of the books he's reading, there's an exclamation, and this is what Warburg is doing. Not trying to tell one single teleological story. That's Cassirer's job.
Yeah.
But Warburg wants to, he's still willing to, as it were, swim in the currents.
Yeah. It's sometimes said of Warburg that his greatest legacy, of course, was his library. And, you know, you mentioned the ellipse. I know the reading room is a great ellipse. And I wonder if you could talk about the library and how it relates to the Bilderatlas.
Right. Well, there you have the tension between word and image, as it were. I mean, not that the library didn't have images. Of course, it was overflowing with them. But that here, this is the archive. Here is the attempt to gather the documents, the monuments, as much as you can, in one place so that they are available to readers, researchers, whom could experience the past, the das Nachleben der Antike, the afterlife of antiquity, mm-hmm. by immersing themselves in the library, which was organized not in a traditional manner, but rather according to the law of good neighbor, quote unquote, or the law of neighborliness, so that the one text, a commentary on Virgil, would be maybe next to a volume about Virgilian painting, would be next to a Senecan commentary on ethics, etc. Mm-hmm. So that the library was organized, if you will, metonymically, just as the Atlas is organized metonymically. But of course, to get lost in the library is much different than getting lost in or gazing at the Atlas. Yeah. And Walbrook knew that, and I think the two things are complementary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important to realize that Walbrook's initial plan for the Atlas was that it be accompanied by several volumes of text. And so those volumes of text, in a sense, point us back to the library,
yeah.
point us back to his corpus of writings and also the library more generally.
Yeah, interesting. And it seems serendipity is built right into the system almost intentionally, isn't it? So that
yes.
you know, the problem with classification systems is if you follow them strictly, you only find what you're looking for. You don't find what you're not looking for. You know, it's always the book next to the book that you're looking for that turns out to be the book that, you know, opens you up to something new. So
yes, Walbrook said it's designed so that you find not the book that you wanted, but the book that you need.
Very interesting, you know, now in this kind of era of digital humanities, when we have all this data, people are trying to organize and find schemas to organize, and it's, of course, interdisciplinary, you know, it's scientific, it's humanists, all sorts of different kinds of taxonomies. And I wonder if it might offer some kind of model for us.
The library, yes. Yeah. The library in particular, I think, insofar as given the digital paradigm, the library would slow you down, would make you does make you think laterally, think more deeply about what you're seeing, and make you realize that the things that you're seeing, say, in the Atlas, have a deep history, and that, in fact, are not only reflected in Walbrook's own writing, so you look at the image and you think, I need to go back to what Walbrook writes about these images, but then you think, well, I need to be more iconographic about it. I need to thickened description rather than just skipping to the next web page or clicking on the next image. So I think a Walbrookian method is a nice antidote to the speed that is sometimes salutary but sometimes dangerous in our digital world.
Yeah, it's about context, but it's also about then God hiding in the details, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So can you talk about, then, you devote a good portion of the book to Giordano Bruno, and can you talk about why he's so important to Warburg, especially in his later years?
Yes. Well, Warburg goes to Rome in June 1928, and he goes with the stated purpose to work on the Atlas, to find more images, to expand the Atlas, to refine it. He gets sidetracked, though, for a good bit of his, he spends almost a year or maybe a little bit more than a year in Rome, holed up in a hotel room by and large. He gets sidetracked by Bruno. He starts to read Bruno and sees him as the antenna, quote-unquote, of European history in the Renaissance. Bruno, who in his own work mediates between the astrological and astronomical traditions. Bruno, whose images, verbal images, are compelling to Walbrook. Bruno, who, of course, suffers as a martyr to science and to the new philosophy. Bruno, who, he is a figure who, like Walbrook, is able to cross disciplinary boundaries. He's an outsider. He becomes almost an obsession for Walbrook. Walbrook immediately buys a collection of books by an Italian editor who had recently passed. He meets with the great philosopher and soon-to-be fascist, or already flirting with fascist, Giovanni Gentile. He's disappointed with Gentile, but he continues on with Bruno. He compares Bruno to Shakespeare. His work on Bruno, which is never published, despite the fact that Saxel and Ernst Gassirer encourages Walbrook, and in fact says to Walbrook, you are the one who can make sense of Bruno. Your method will finally give us an understanding of it. Despite all this encouragement, Walbrook only fills a notebook with his thoughts about Bruno. But to my mind, it's in a sense the great intellectual project that begins to take shape in his last years. Mm-hmm. And he truly sees Bruno as a kindred spirit, but also someone who offers solutions to the very same questions that Warburg himself is asking. Yeah. It's interesting that Kassirer, in his funeral oration that he gives for Warburg in early 1930, ends it with this comparison between Bruno and Warburg, and, yeah, and says, again, expresses his great disappointment that this never comes to fruition. So the book tries, in a sense, to describe what was at stake and why this anachronic or synchronic encounter.
Interesting. That's a beautiful thing, by the way, the Kassirer's Enconium.
Yes, quoting Petrarchan poetry. Yeah. And
so, a last question, I think. As a comparatist yourself, you know, I wonder if your work with Warburg and the Atlas has influenced your own approach to literature and culture. Has the Atlas as a thought space had an effect, in other words, on your own personal thought space?
Absolutely. I think Warburg's taught me to be a nimbler, more expressive thinker and mm-hmm. writer about literature, that one can create a thought space where there are moving parts that, yes, have very strong historical roots, but that to really understand something I'm working on right now, for instance, the legacy of Ovid and how a text like Ovid's Metamorphoses can both influence the entirety of the Renaissance visual and literary arts, or almost the entirety, and yet still move someone like Louis Zukofsky to read Shakespeare with Spinoza. In that sense, the Warburgian combinatory art remains front and center in what I do. I mean, another example would be translation and the history of literary translations. Translation as the means, cultural, expressive means for ideas to cross boundaries, for ideas to repeat themselves, and images, metaphors to repeat themselves in different guises and different contexts. And I'd also add that Warburg himself became friendly late in his life with Ernst Robert Curtius. And Curtius, his great book on European literature in the Latin Middle Ages, is dedicated to Warburg. Mm-hmm. And Curtius is a major influence to me. So if Curtius can follow the topoi or the literary commonplaces that repeat themselves over the course of history and become vehicles for expression and representation in different places and climes, I think we would be well served to pursue that kind of inquiry. The last thought, from a more conceptual or even theoretical point of view, is I very much have long been influenced and continue to try to puzzle out what Hans Blumenberg, the great 20th century German intellectual historian, calls metaphorology. And metaphorology for Blumenberg is, in his massive tomes, is how what he calls absolute metaphors, metaphors such as the Book of the World or, say, the metaphors of light and clarity in Descartes, how these things can't be reduced to logical formulas, how they still have in them what Blumenberg and Husserl call elements of the life world, and mm-hmm. that metaphors are ways of writers, philosophers, artists encountering both the tradition that may be past or may be attenuating, and the world of our everyday experience. And I think Warburg, like Blumenberg, is able to do that kind of intellectual history, but also remind us why we do that intellectual history or literary history, that it matters.
Yeah, there's a whole epistemology hiding in the notion of metaphor.
It's a way of knowing the world. It's a way of telling about the world, expressing the world. And unlike the symbol, I know why metaphor is important for Warburg and for me, is that metaphor has a greater discursivity, and ultimately, as you say, it may have greater epistemological power.
Yeah. So you're just about to go off for a 5-year stint at the Warburg Library?
Yes. They have, with German funding, so this is a wonderful collaboration, long time in fruition. There's a research project called, it is a German title and an English subtitle, it's called Bilderfahrzeuge, Vehicles of Images, or Image Vehicles, Abi Warburg and the Future of Iconology. And it's going to be a team of researchers who will be working on their own projects, but also asking how the legacy of Vaublog might be instrumental to current and future scholarship. And it's going to be housed in London at the Vaublog Institute, and bringing together scholars from German, American, English, so people from all over. And so I'm very much looking forward to that and adapting what I have learned and continue to learn from Vaublog to other questions like translation, yeah. like the reception of Ovid, like Blumenberg.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, and nice to live in London for 5 years, too. I think.
Hope we can afford it.
Yes. Yeah. So I want to thank you, Christopher, for joining us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Memory, Metaphor, and Abbie Vorberg's Atlas of Images.
Thank you, Thomas, for a delightful conversation.
Yeah, it's been lovely. Thanks.